if we kind of start looking at the specific levers that we have, the things that you can do to try and improve. And so starting with diet, how at a high level, how do you think about nutrition? What do we know about what is the kind of the best diet, and is it different for different people?
Yeah. Generally speaking, I think for what we know from a demographic standpoint is that if you look at blue zone data, if you look at where people live the longest, they tend to be, you know, Mediterranean diet, pesco vegetarian, that kind of thing. Nothing that, again, if you really want to eat a Mediterranean diet, you know, all the time, then more power to you. I enjoy all sorts of different kinds of food. So that's not necessarily what I do. But I think some basic principles, I think, are some guiding principles would be useful. And the things that I think that are biggest are, first, as I think you've sort of alluded to before, one is this concept of having periods of time in which you are not eating. You can call that intermittent fasting, or time-restricted feeding is what I actually follow myself, which would be limiting. In my case, I limit my calorie intake about 6 or 7 hours per day. Mm-hmm. But typically that, you know, when you talk about time restricted feeding, can be 8 hours. Certainly 8 hours is where a lot of the studies are. That concept alone is of significant value. There's a lot of data, and obviously in the lab with regard to calorie restriction, it's enormous. There's enormous data on longevity in the laboratory. With humans, we know that you have a improvement in insulin resistance, you know, lipids and improve, you know, high blood pressure improves. You also have a significant improvement in health and overall. So the one concept I like to think of is, again, having periods of time when you are not eating as much. By the way, that's not just the clinical ramifications of that, but that also, at least in the lab, we know that it upregulates multiple longevity pathways, right? Sirtuins and the cyclic AMP pathways, and downregulates mTOR. So we know that that eating less often is probably one of the key elements. The next important thing there, which I think is extraordinarily important, is keeping an eye on the intake of carbohydrates, and specifically trying to monitor your blood glucose to make sure that it does not get out of control. Higher blood glucose is, I think it's subclinical diabetes. In other words, people are just walking around with some hyperglycemia that's being undertreated, is such an underappreciated problem. I think even with physicians, we just don't treat it aggressively enough. I always view blood sugar as a type of these spikes as sort of a slime that comes into our blood, and you know, if it gets too high, it just latches onto the machinery that we need to function and makes it not work as well. And that's effectively what's happening. High blood sugar, hyperglycemia, underlies so many other disease processes, whether that's, you know, cardiovascular disease, you know, and it's just any number of disease processes, dementia, high blood pressure. So keeping really good control of your glycemic state. So what does that mean? How do you do it, I guess, is the question. There's a couple of things that I can tell you that I do that might be helpful. One is trying to understand how your own body works. You certainly can certainly look up the different types of glycemic indices of food to see what types of food will be more likely to spike your blood sugar. So breads, pastas, things like that. But what I found is with the continuous glucose monitor, which you can just slap on yourself and typically for about 2 weeks at a time, you can get really good data on yourself. And why that's important is that What I think is interesting is that people are very, very different when it comes to reacting to food. And we generally have these glycemic indices out there for general guidance, but everyone I've talked to who's used a continuous glucose monitor finds interesting quirks in their own body. So for example, I will dabble in dessert once in a while, and I feel very guilty about it when I do. But what I found was that if I had that dessert after a meal, and that meal consisted of your, typical, you had a salad and maybe you had some proteins and things like that, I actually didn't really spike. And on the other hand, if I had Thai food, for some reason, my blood sugar spikes immensely. So that kind of personal data is extremely important, because whatever the glycemic indices tell you, that's one thing. But to know how your own body is reacting to any given food is priceless data. I'll point out too that, and I'm sure you'll get to this later, the real-time blood sugar is one thing, but also keeping track of that via a hemoglobin A1C, which is essentially an average of the previous 3 months, is really, really important as well. So blood sugar. And the third part of diet, I would say, is protein. This is something that, especially if you are doing intermittent fasting, it's easy to not get enough protein. And how much protein is the right amount of protein? That's a tricky one. I think that the answer is probably depending on how much you exercise. I've heard, Peter Attia talks about a gram per pound. That's an awful lot of protein. And for me, I'm about 215 pounds, and that would mean about 2 or 16 ounce ribeye steaks per day. That's a lot of protein. But maybe, if I'm exercising and I'm lifting a lot of weight, maybe that is adequate. Maybe that's right. It certainly probably is not a problem. However, that amount of protein for somebody who's relatively sedentary, I don't think that's such a great idea. There is a huge issue there with where that protein needs to be metabolized. And I can foresee, issues in the future with kidney disease and that kind of thing as well. So you got to be careful, somewhere between a half gram and a gram, depending on the amount you exercise and do, weight training, I think is probably reasonable. So I think, to me, those are some of the, I think, easy things to think about: eating less, keeping really good control of blood sugar, and keeping making sure you get enough protein. By the way, with regard to protein, I try to eat usually a salad or, try to get my green leafy vegetables mostly at lunch. I was finding that I was not probably getting enough protein because I lift weights as well. And so I've supplemented with a whey protein as well. And I found that to be very, very useful. So,
yes. So we did talk to one guest who said, so instead of it being a gram per pound, it should be 1 gram per pound of your ideal weight. So it's like you don't include the fat.
Sure. Maybe that's true, but it's still going to be a lot.
So I did try a CGM, but for me, it seemed like every time I had carbohydrates, it spiked. It's like I couldn't really see the difference. How big is the difference between like your Thai and your dessert? I mean, what kind of numbers did you get for those?
So if I had dessert in isolation, say I just, the kids randomly wanted to have ice cream, I would spike.
Right.
But if it was a sit-down dinner and, say, 15 minutes later, I had a piece of cake, I would not spike. And I was as shocked as anyone else could be that that was the case. And, not that I took it as a free pass to have dessert anytime. But people are different. There are some hacks along the way, too. I do also, and you know, depending on your relationship with your doctor, I do walk around with a little bit of acarbose. Mm-hmm. And so, taking a little acarbose certainly can blunt the glycemic effect of anything. So there's that. If you can't get that, there's certainly apple cider vinegar is another one. Before a meal, apple cider vinegar can if you have a teaspoon of apple cider vinegar and a cup of water before a meal, it can blunt a glycemic, like a sugar spike, as much as 30%. So that's an easy one to do.